1963 was a year of fulfillment and of tragedy for us. First, there was Birmingham with the sense of hope and accomplishment we derived from it. Then, hardly a month later, on June 12th, the young Mississippi NAACP leader Medgar Evers was shot dead in the very door of his home in Jackson. Then, since Martin was greatly troubled by sporadic outbreaks of rioting in some cities, he felt that a great peaceful demonstration in Washington would serve the double purpose of providing the black masses with a chance for nonviolent protest, and at the same time would put pressure on Congress to pass President Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill. The Washington March was set for August 28, 1963. It was to be a short march down the mall from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial, where the speeches would be made. The sound of typewriters and voices in the next room awakened me early. I found my husband watching the crowds from the window of our hotel suite. As it approached the time that the march was to begin, we became anxious about how large the turnout would be. The reports on television were very discouraging. "A very small number of people have assembled," they said. Before we left the hotel, they were saying about 25,000. We were subdued and saddened because that was a far cry from the 100,000 we had hoped for. Then, when we reached the mall, our spirits soared. The reporters had grossly underestimated the crowd. There were 90,000 assembled by 10 o'clock, and by the time we arrived, that whole vast green concourse was alive with 250,000 people. They had come by plane, train, bus, automobile, some by bicycle, and a few by foot, from all parts of the nation. Almost a fourth of that enormous crowd was white. It was a beautiful sight. The way it worked out has often been told. The leaders did not really lead the great march on Washington, because by the time they got lined up, all those tens of thousands of people who had been waiting for hours had assembled themselves and moved in great procession to the Lincoln Memorial. The leaders fell into the line of march with the people. We knew that in addition there were millions watching on television, including President Kennedy and the White House. A. Philip Randolph introduced Martin. He called my husband the moral leader of the nation. 250,000 people applauded thunderously and voiced in a sort of chant, "Martin Luther King." Martin was tremendously moved. I could tell by the line of his back and the sound of his voice. A little husky at first, then going out in a strong and beautifully resonant tone that came when he was inspired to his best. He started out with the written speech, delivering it with great eloquence. His main contention was that, instead of honoring her sacred obligations, America had given the Negro a bad check. "We are here today to redeem that check, and we will not accept the idea that there is no money in the Bank of Justice." When he got to the rhythmic part of demanding freedom now and wanting jobs now, the crowd caught the timing and shouted, "Now!" in a cadence. Their response lifted Martin in a surge of emotion to new heights of inspiration. Abandoning his written speech, forgetting time, he spoke from his heart, his voice soaring magnificently out over that great crowd and over to all the world. It seemed to all of us there that day that his words flowed from some higher place through Martin to the weary people before him. Yea, heaven itself opened up, and we all seemed transformed. He said, "I say to you today, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream that is deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even in the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children one day will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountains of despair the stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "Let freedom ring." So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. When we allow freedom to ring from every town and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, great God Almighty, we are free at last. As Martin ended, there was the awed silence that is the greatest tribute an orator can be paid. And then a tremendous crash of sound as 250,000 people shouted in ecstatic accord with his words. The feeling that they had of oneness and unity was complete. They kept on shouting in one thunderous voice, and for that brief moment, the kingdom of God seemed to have come on earth. In the early years when he first preached nonviolence, Martin would be asked the inevitable question put to all men of his belief: what would you do if someone were attacking your wife? He would answer then, "I'm not sure, but I hope that I would not respond with violence." Later, as his ideals of nonviolence were tested in fire, he was able to answer more surely, confident out of his terrible experiences, that he would not strike out. Martin was always saddened by the outbreaks of violence, not only because of the death and destruction that resulted, but also because he felt that such events set back the cause of black freedom. He was intensely sympathetic to the despairing blacks who rioted, and he understood their reasons. As he said, "Rioting is the language of the unheard." He also realized that palliative measures were not enough, and that the roots of black discontent lay in the appalling poverty in which they existed. Lived is too fine a word. This must somehow be corrected. At the same time, he felt that the burning and killing and looting terrified people, black as well as white, and intensified white backlash without accomplishing any but the most token reforms. Many whites felt guilty about the deprivations of the Negroes, and these outbreaks eased their consciences and gave them an excuse to say, "If the Negroes are going to behave in this irresponsible way, they don't deserve the rights they are demanding." Rioting gave the white establishment an easy way out. Martin had always tried to channel the frustrations and anger of oppressed people into constructive courses, into massive, nonviolent, though militant demonstrations. He had a wonderful power of persuasion and could often talk even the most bitter proponents of violence out of their radical intentions. Many of them became his unarmed bodyguards. Others suppressed violent tendencies in the ranks, and more than a few converted so completely to nonviolence that they joined the staff of SCLC. Martin did not have a one-dimensional, negative view of black nationalism. He saw it partially as black self-respect trying to surface. He realized that it was not necessarily anti-white, but that it is extremely difficult to be proudly black and to feel equal in so repressive a white society. Above all, he kept in mind that the whites who reproached militants in self-righteous indignation conveniently forgot that the evil was caused by white racism in the first place. Yet Martin would not compromise with hate of violence, and the careful balance he maintained earned him respect from both whites and blacks who could not yet understand each other. In February, there appeared a small but troublesome cloud on the horizon. In Memphis, Tennessee, the Sanitation Workers Union, most of whose members were black, had gone on strike because of the unjust treatment they were receiving from the newly elected mayor, Henry Loeb. On February 23rd, a small peaceful demonstration march by the union had been brutally broken up by police using clubs and mace with squad cars as a sort of cavalry. This action outraged not only black people in Memphis, but many whites as well. What had been a small strike by an obscure local union became a citywide protest movement in which SCLC's local affiliate, headed by Jim Lawson, took a leading part. Predominantly white AFL-CIO unions joined in. Jim telephoned Martin for help. Martin went to Memphis to address a huge mass meeting, and while he was there, Lawson asked him to lead a protest march in Memphis on March 28th. The march had already started when Martin got there, so he rushed by automobile to the head of the line. He soon realized that the march was not well disciplined. There was never even a proper line formed. Black power placards were being held by some marchers, and there were other things about the demonstration that Martin did not know. For example, some of the younger black nationalists had threatened to break up the march if they were not given recognition. This had been a problem throughout the Memphis strike, but no one had told my husband about it. He had gone no more than a few blocks when he heard crashing glass and the sounds of rocks and bottles being thrown from the back of the line. It has been generally agreed that the trouble had not been started by the marchers, but by gangs of young men who, using the parade as a cover, hurled rocks through windows and dodged in and out of the ranks to lose their identity among them. It turned into a horrible situation. Mayor Loeb had brought the tension about in the first place by refusing even to discuss grievances. Now his police were ready and brutally moved in on the marchers. Loeb also sent for the National Guard. Many people were beaten up, and one young man was shot in the back and killed. When he got home, Martin told me that he felt that after the violence started, the police were completely unrestrained. This was the first time violence had ever broken out in a march he was leading. Although he knew that he was not responsible, he felt terrible about what had happened. Martin came home Sunday evening. He was to go to Memphis Wednesday morning on a 7 o'clock flight. Ralph Abernathy came by the house to pick up Martin. Neither Ralph nor Martin ate anything. They even refused coffee and juice. I followed Martin to the door, kissed him goodbye, and wished him well. The children were still asleep, and they did not see him off. It was an ordinary goodbye like thousands of other times before. Millions and millions of people for days and days, as the tape was run and rerun, watched Martin speak at the meeting that night. Yet he almost had not gone because a violent rainstorm came up and Ralph Abernathy had felt that not many people would come. Martin needed rest, and Ralph volunteered to go and speak for him. However, when Ralph got to Claiborne Temple, he found that about 2,000 people had turned out in spite of the weather. They applauded him politely, but he knew they were disappointed. Ralph left the platform and telephoned Martin, urging him to come to address the waiting crowd. Martin put on his raincoat and went directly to the meeting. Ralph said, "I knew this was not my crowd. They wanted to hear Martin." As always, no matter how Martin had felt beforehand, the enthusiasm of the people inspired him. That night, completely spontaneously, he gave one of his greatest speeches. First, he told the citizens of Memphis that he was heart and soul with them, that their cause was just, and that he and his organization would fight for them. He said that even if the federal injunction was not lifted, he would lead the march on Monday. He had the audience roaring with excitement, and he responded in kind. Then the mantle of prophecy seemed to descend upon Martin. He told the people that his plane from Atlanta had been delayed that morning because Dr. Martin Luther King is aboard, and there was a search for a possible bomb. He told of how, when he got to Memphis, there were threats and rumors of an attack on him. Then Martin said, "I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter to me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop, I won't mind. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." So intense was the audience's emotional response to Martin's words, so high was his own exaltation responding to their excitement, the action and reaction of one to the other, that he was overcome. He broke off there. I believe he intended to finish the quotation, "His truth is marching on." But he could not. The next afternoon, Thursday, April 4th, I went shopping with Yolanda. I had not been home very long when the telephone rang. It was Jesse Jackson. He said, "Coretta, Doc just got shot. I would advise you to take the next thing smoking." It hit me hard, not surprise, but shock, that the call I seemed subconsciously to have been waiting for all our lives had come. I asked for details, and Jesse, trying to spare me, said he was shot in the shoulder. I sensed it was quite serious, and I wanted to ask how seriously hurt he was, but I was afraid. I said, "I'll check the next flight." "They've taken him to St. Joseph's Hospital," said Jesse. "Why don't you come to the hotel, and then we'll get you to the hospital?" Somehow I felt it might have been fatal, and I called Dora MacDonald and asked her to come over. Then Andy Young called from Memphis and told me Martin's condition was very serious. He's not dead, Andy said. It was about 7:20 then, and I told him I'd be on the 8:25 flight. Andy said, all right, we'll be looking for you. He was shot in the neck. Bring someone with you. Dora's on her way over, I answered. Bring Dora, Andy said. Maybe Juanita Abernathy can come. I'll call her, I added. I turned on the television. They were talking about Martin, reporting what I already knew. By that time, the children had come into the room, and although I tried to turn the TV down, they had already heard enough to know that something had happened to their father. They asked, what is it? Yoki said, don't tell me, don't tell me, and ran crying from the room. But she soon came back. I said to her, I'm getting ready to go to Memphis because your daddy has been shot. All the children were in the room, and Yolanda started to help me pack. It was the first time she had ever offered to do so. Then the telephone rang again. The voice said, Mrs. King, this is Mayor Allen. I called to ask if there's any help I can give. I said, well, I'm leaving for Memphis on the 8:25 flight. Mayor Allen said, I'm coming over myself, and I'll try to get there before you leave. I'll send an officer over to go with you. While I was getting ready, friends from all over town began coming in. Then Mayor Allen came with his wife. Dora MacDonald had come and then gone home to get her things and meet me at the airport. It was now 8:00. As I started to leave, Dexter asked me, Mommy, when will you be back? I said, Dexter, I'll call you from Memphis and let you know when I'll be back. Mommy, when will Daddy be back? Dexter, I'll call you from Memphis and let you know. Then, of course, I kissed all the children goodbye. Christine and her husband Isaac came with me to the airport with the mayor and Mrs. Allen and Reverend Fred Bennett and his wife Benita. As we walked up the long corridor full of hurrying people, it all seemed unreal, nightmarish. Mayor Allen said to me, it's such a senseless thing. When will people ever learn? Then I heard my name echoing over the public address system. Someone is paging me, I said. And I had a strange, cold feeling, for I knew it was the word from Memphis, and that the word was bad. By this time, we had reached the gate to board the plane. I asked the mayor to have someone check the page for me. A few minutes later, I saw Dora MacDonald walking toward me very fast, and I noticed the expression on her face as she came running up. She said, come on, we need a room where we can sit down. Then I knew Martin was dead. I knew Martin did not want any fanfare or extravagant tributes. The main thing he was concerned about was that his funeral be in keeping with the kind of life he had led and the principles he had lived by. I don't think he would have been concerned that a large number of people attended. I told the press that Martin would have wanted SCLC to continue under the leadership of Ralph Abernathy, Andrew Young, and others. I thanked all of our friends at SCLC, at Ebenezer, and throughout the world who had rallied to help at this painful time. Then I talked about Martin and said, My husband often told the children that if a man had nothing that was worth dying for, then he was not fit to live. He said also that it's not how long you live, but how well you live. He knew that at any moment his physical life could be cut short, and we faced this possibility squarely and honestly. My husband faced the possibility of death without bitterness or hatred. He knew that this was a sick society totally infested with racism and violence that questioned his integrity, maligned his motives, and distorted his views, which would ultimately lead to his death, and he struggled with every ounce of his energy to save that society from itself. He never hated. He never despaired of well-doing, and he encouraged us to do likewise, and so he prepared us constantly for the tragedy. I am surprised and pleased at the success of his teaching, for our children say calmly, "Daddy is not dead. He may be physically dead, but his spirit will never die." Ours has been a religious home, and this too has made this burden easier to bear. Our concern now is that his work does not die. He gave his life for the poor of the world, the garbage workers of Memphis, and the peasants of Vietnam. Nothing hurt him more than that man could attempt no way to solve problems except through violence. He gave his life in search of a more excellent way, a more effective way, a creative rather than a destructive way. We intend to go on in search of that way, and I hope that you who loved and admired him would join us in fulfilling his dream. The day that Negro people and others in bondage are truly free, on the day want is abolished, on the day wars are no more, on that day I know my husband will rest in a long-deserved peace. Saturday morning, Harry Belafonte said to me, "I want to talk to you about something that has been on my mind. You don't have to agree, but think about it. I think you should go to Memphis and march on Monday if it isn't too much for you. It would mean a great deal to people throughout the nation for you just to be there." Immediately I replied, "I agree. I think Martin would have wanted me to go." I had not thought about it before, but now that you raise the question, I would really like to go. I may even take the children. So on Monday, I flew to Memphis with Harry Belafonte, Justine Smadback, and my three oldest children in a plane Harry provided. There was no difficulty in Memphis. In the shock and sorrow of Martin's death, the federal injunction against the march was either forgotten or rescinded. There was hardly a person in America who would have dared or even wanted to enforce it. We were rushed from the airport to the head of the line, and we marched about a mile to City Hall, Ralph Abernathy and the children walking beside me. There were 25,000, perhaps 50,000 people marching, some of whom had come to Memphis from all parts of the country for this demonstration. There were dense crowds of people along the route who did not cheer or wave, but stood silent in Martin's memory. Even my children seemed to sense the sympathy and compassion those people felt for us. Of course, the children sat on the platform with me at City Hall. When it came my turn to speak, Harry Belafonte introduced me. I talked about Martin's qualities as a leader and as a husband and a father. I talked about his work, his great hope for social and economic justice for all. I explained Martin's concept of redemptive suffering and that he had been prepared to give his life to the cause in which he believed. However, in closing, I ask a question. how many men must die before we can really have a free and true and peaceful society? How long will it take? If we can catch the spirit and the true meaning of this experience, I believe this nation can be transformed into a society of love, of justice, peace, and brotherhood, where all men can really be brothers. When I finished, I received an accolade from my daughter. Yolanda said, "Mommy, you are real good." That experience in Memphis and the inspiration I derived from it helped me to get through those first days and also the long days ahead. I was so uplifted by the spirit of the people, the inspiration I gained from them. I hope I gave back to them by being there. You see, I feel strongly that Martin's work must go on. In the same way that I had given him all the support I could during his lifetime, I was even more determined to do so now that he was no longer with us. I felt that I must rededicate myself to the completion of his work. Also, I felt that not only must I do this, but that if enough individuals joined in the work, Martin's dream would be realized, and his death will have served the redemptive purpose which he talked about so often. Not that I can do what Martin did, but I hope to make my contribution in my own way. In some small way, perhaps I can serve as he did. The aspirations of oppressed people of all races throughout the world.